Londra rækjama við nefnum margir Turon space that interfering with the image and causing blunting of the cost of any candle. The fifth item that you always want to visualize the hilum, and you want the hilum really right and the left hilum not to be more than, I mean the left hilum should not be more than 1 centimeter. And also as a rule of thumb, you just when you put your thumb, it should not be bigger than your thumb when you measure it. Anything larger than that indicates that there is a hilum object. And the hilum consists of either blood vessel or you cannot diagnose adenopathy or lymph nodes based on chest x-ray. You need the other modality. So this is why you say hilum congestion or hilum enlargement. Other things that also you want to know, the vascular marking are more prominent in the bases of the lung. So you don't want the vascular here to be very, very prominent as opposed to here. It indicates more of pulmonary vascular congestion if it's very engorged here as well as here. But normally it should be based on the gravity. This should be more prominent at the base compared to the lung. And also you don't want to see a prominent vasculature also at the periphery of the lung, because if there is a prominent vasculature, that probably indicate either a vascular congestion, lymphatic congestion, or interstitial abnormalities. So this is also another thing that goes into your mind. When you look into a lateral film, the reasons that we anatomically want to locate where is the abnormality or where is the lesion and the chest x-ray that you saw. So if you see that area, that space, this is the retrosternal space, this is anything that occupy this territory, we call it anterior mediastinal structure. Anything occupy the heart, within the heart, this is a medial mediastinal structure. Anything behind the heart, from here to here, this is a posterior mediastinal structure. Anything above the aortic arch, from here upward, we call it a superior mediastinal structure. So basically we use the lateral x-ray for locating abnormalities in the lung parenchyma, where is it exactly, and at the same time if there is really a mass, then you want to anatomically locate it, because a certain place is really more peculiar to a certain type of masses, and it will help you in terms of the differential diagnosis. So if you have an anterior mediastinal mass, meaning it's behind the retrosternal, remember the four T's, okay, the letter T's. So it's either thymoma, teratoma, thyroid, and then the lymphoma, but in order to make a T, then we added the word terrible lymphoma. But just this is really the, this is a general knowledge for you. It's important to know it, but it will not be brought in the exam, but it's nice to know about this. Middle mediastinal masses, it's the three A's. So the anterior is the four T's, the middle is the three A's. Anything with related to lymph node or aneurysm or congenital anomalies, abnormality in the, for example, in the bronchial wall, would we have a bronchiogenic cyst, or in the pericardium when they have a pericardial cyst, or in the esophagus, and there is an what we call it, esophageal cyst. If it's in the posterior, it's almost always a neurogenic type of tumor. So it's this is why we anatomically try to really locate where is that mass, because it's really it really helps us what's the origin of that mass. And mostly we divide them into either the neural type tumor, the neuroblastoma, the ganglioblastoma, schwannoma, if there is a nerve root involvement. So this is a gentleman who's a 30 years old gentleman who presented with an incidental finding. He doesn't have any symptoms of cough or shortness of breath. And just part of the routine workup or evaluation, they did a chest x-ray and they found this abnormality. So the thing that when you go, you want to look into it, you don't jump into this right away. So you go again to this position. So you draw that line, an imaginary line, and then you try the trial in the middle, and you find that it goes It's perfect centered here, but all of a sudden there is something is pushing it. So it has nothing to do with the position of the patient. It's there is something is pushing the trachea to the opposite side. Okay? Mm-hmm. Then the other thing is that we can say this is a properly a PA view because you can see the entire lung beautifully without any really magnifying images with of the heart or the vascular structure. The costophrenic angle beautifully here. The vascular structure is really also beautiful here. And then the cardiac size is within normal limit. The only thing that we see there is an abnormal structure and a white opacity is occupying here, if you see that structure. And that opacity is pushing the trachea or the mediastinum to the opposite side. Okay. Now from this position or from this film, you cannot really tell whether this is an anterior, posterior, medial. Then what you need to do is ask for a lateral film. And the lateral film indeed, it shows that this is the heart, it's perfect, the white hair. There's nothing here, so I immediately exclude that it has nothing to do with posterior mediastinal structure. So I'm not really dealing with kind of a neurogenic type of tumor. Mm-hmm. But what I see here is really that this mass, you see that the aortic arch here, this is the mass is occupying the superior mediastinal structure, okay? And there's also, if there is no retrosternal space. Mm-hmm. So it's a superior and extending into the anterior, and that's why the retrosternal space is really obliterated or removed because of that or occupied by that mass. And this is turned to be a thymoma in a young man. A thymoma, which is the anterior mediastinal. We remember the T, we would say four T's. So just to revise again, midline, trachea in the middle. You want to see the PA view, the costophrenic angle very sharp, heart size within the almost half of the diameter you want it of the entire transverse diameter. The hilum is really looks within 1 to 1 centimeter above the left above the hilum, but it's not enlarged. And we move on now to into the lung parenchyma itself. So you may probably, when you are rounding with your colleagues in the whatever specialty, you may probably heard the word air bronchogram. The air bronchogram is being repetitively used, and it's always used among the medical as well as the radiological specialties. And what does it indicate, the air bronchogram? So it, remember, the air bronchogram, it does not specify what disease this patient has. So it is not pathognomic for any kind of disease. So basically, it just tell you that indicate that the opacity is in the parenchyma and not in the mediastinum or the pleura. Mm-hmm. So you know, when you see an air bronchogram, you're almost 100% certain that this abnormality is in the lung parenchyma. You're not dealing with the mediastinal structure and you're not dealing with the pleura. And basically, anything that can cause air bronchogram, consolidation, a hemorrhage, edema, bronchiogenic cell carcinoma, lymphoma, sarcoid, anything. So what do we mean here? We will come to this in a second. So this is a 30 years old gentleman who presented with a history of shortness of breath over the past 1 week and fever. And he's also, he was very tachycardic. On examination, his temperature is 39, blood pressure is 90 over 60. And oxygen saturation is 88% on room air. And lung examination reveals diminished breath sounds and diminished expansion bilaterally with also bilateral inspiratory crackles. So how would you approach to this patient? What would you do to this patient? ABC, extremely important. So don't jump into the chest x-ray. Don't immediately, whether you have an OSCE exam, you have a real-life case scenario, you have a written exam, always go by the ABC in your mind. So you want to make sure that his airway breathing and circulation. So what do you want to do to this patient? Okay, so right away you are going to put him on oxygen, okay, whether it's a nasal prong or a face mask. What else? Establish an IV access right away. Make sure you have an IV access, preferably large 18 gauge bilaterally, both sides. What else? Okay, we'll give him an IV fluid immediately. Why you want to give him an IV fluid? Right, what kind of IV fluid do you want to give him? Normosaline, okay, that's good. You don't want to give him half normal, or you want to really expand his intravascular volume. This is a very important thing. What else? Right. Right now, you want to stabilize your patient. So you want to improve his oxygen, and you want to also improve his blood pressure and hemodynamics. Then you want to move on into the investigation, which is extremely important. The first one is the ABG. Okay. Don't ask for a chest X-ray because the chest X-ray is in front of you. So don't waste your time. Okay, so ABG is a very important, and what you're going to look into the ABG? Okay, the first thing, your eyesight will drop into where? The PO2. Okay, but the way it's written in the ABG, it's written as a pH, PaCO2, and PO2, and then the bicarb, and then the saturation. But you ignore everything. The first thing that your eyes drop immediately to the PO2. Because based on that PO2 that you will decide whether this patient will go into a different modality. You might probably want to go from, rather than nasal cannula, then you might probably use a non-invasive ventilation or invasive ventilation that requires intubation. So the first thing that you want to eyeball is the PaO2. And the second thing that you want to eyeball is the PaCO2. The PaCO2, if he's low, less than 30, that means he's hyperventilated, and this is probably as a consequence of the hypoxia and the infiltrate or the pneumonia that he has. If it's high, so that means that he's probably what? He's failing, his muscle is fatigued. Okay, and that's why he's retaining now CO2, and that's a possibility. Or there is something else is causing it from central, like if he has a component of that causes central nervous system depression, whether related to drugs, infection, bleed, lesion, whatever. And the last thing that you will look into the pH. Okay, you want to see if this patient is acidotic or or he has an alkalosis. So after the ABG, then you move on into the, immediately you want to do the CBC, right? And the CBC, what you are you going to eyeball?
White blood cells.
White blood cells immediately. What else in the CBC? Very important.
Hemoglobin.
Three important items in the CBC, and you always keep it in the back of your mind.
Hematocrit.
Hematocrit. Platelet. Because the hemoglobin is the hemat. So really, if you want to look at the hematocrit, that's fine. You want to look at the hemoglobin, but choose one. But three things that you want to really focus on. The CWBC, hemoglobin, and the last one is the platelet, and then we'll come to it in a minute, why we are looking at this. Afterward, you want to do probably what in this patient? You want to look into the sputum, gram stain, and culture. You want to do a septic workup, blood culture. Remember, this patient is septic. Okay, so you want to do all of this. And then how are you going to manage him?
Empiric.
Okay, so what do you want to give him? Okay. No. Yeah, but what kind of broad spectrum antibiotic you want to give him? Remember, what is the case scenario? This case scenario, this patient presented from the community. So you really need to cover what?
Strep.
Right, so you want to cover pneumococci, right? Pneumococcal pneumonia. You want to cover what? Gram negative, although it's less likely here, but you know, this is a possibility, like the Klebsiella that sometimes that can occur in those patients. And you want to cover most commonly is the mycoplasma or Legionnaire disease. So immediately, if someone coming from the community, you want to start them right away on third generation cephalosporin, ceftriaxone, and macrolides, which is the clarithromycin or azithromycin as given as IV. If I presented this patient and I say, 2 months ago this patient was hospitalized and he was in the hospital for the past 3 weeks, then immediately you shift your antibiotic coverage now, rather than focusing on gram-positive, now you want to focus mostly on hospital-acquired pneumonia, which is the gram-negative pathogen. So you have to really say, I want to give him more focus, which is a hospital-acquired infection, more like a piperacillin and tazobactam, and in addition, you may probably want to give him ciprofloxacin. So this is another thing that you want to really focus, because they're going to die from gram-negative pathogens. This is really the most important thing that you want to really, what is the case scenario? Coming from the hospital, coming from community acquired, or someone who is immunocompromised, whether he had a transplantation, whatever organ he had, or he had an underlying immune suppression from drugs, or whatever is the cause, you have to really interpret this according to the context of the patient, what is he presenting to you. And then we move on now, after you do all this and you start an antibiotic, then you move on into looking to the chest x-ray. The chest x-ray here, that when you do that, again, that drawing, you can see that clearly that this patient is not positioned properly, because he's more shifted, and this is not really something is pushing the trachea. And in addition, that you will see that a complete opacification of the lung bilaterally, okay, diffuse infiltrate, and this is what we call the air bronchogram. Do you see that branching dark shadow? Mm-hmm. This is the air bronchogram. So I know this patient does not have a pleural disease based on what I'm seeing here. I know this is, he has a parenchymal abnormalities, and most likely with the clinical history, he has probably a pneumonia. Could this be a case of pulmonary hemorrhage? Absolutely. Could this be a case of congestive heart failure? Absolutely. The film exactly the same. So they always, you interpret the radiological findings with the case was presented to you. Mm-hmm. So make sure you read the case carefully and interpret the finding according to the clinical scenario. That's another case also here that is showing the air bronchogram. This is behind the heart. You can see it here. And this is in a case of someone who has a connective tissue disease with pulmonary hemorrhage. So this is a different case scenario. So the pulmonary hemorrhage, what are the causes of pulmonary hemorrhage? We divide them into two types. Whether pulmonary hemorrhage related to pulmonary renal, this is a combined, and usually when we say pulmonary renal, that means there is an underlying vasculitis, type of small medium type of vasculitis, small medium vessel size, which is commonly the Wegener's, the lupus, the good pasture, and the polyarthritis nodosa, and the Henoction line purpura. All these can cause pulmonary hemorrhage with a combination of the meaning that the lung is involved with this bleeding process. In addition, the kidney, when you evaluate his kidney function, you'll find that there is abnormalities, whether he has a cast in the urine or he has an RBC in the urine. So this is the way that you interpret these findings. Or in a patient who does not have a renal involvement, it could be primarily due to the lung, and this is someone who's been placed on anticoagulation or pulmonary infection or pulmonary embolism with infarction, or someone who had trauma or post bone marrow transplant. I'm not going to really go into detail of this pulmonary hemorrhage, but we'll just spend more important time with this case with the pleural effusion. Pleural effusion, really, it's a wide differential diagnosis. Can be from infection all the way to a pulmonary embolism. So this is a gentleman who presented, a 55 years old gentleman who was in a good health. He was referred from prison because of shortness of breath and weight loss over the past 2 months and dry cough. Clinical exam, he has vital signs are all stable, and lung exam reveals the expansion reduced on the affected side, and stony dullness on the affected side, and absent breath sounds on the affected side. So when I give this scenario, what does it come to your mind? So pleural effusion. So this is not going to be a pneumonia. You will not have pneumonia with the stony dullness. You are not going to have pneumonia with absent breath sound. All of this information is very unusual to have. And someone who has 2 months, this is very unusual to have a pneumonia. This is most likely I'm dealing with a pleural effusion. And then you're going to say, where is that pleural effusion? Right. So I will remember, when I give you that information, I will say in the affected side, but your job is to say it's in the left side pleural effusion. So again, back again to this. What we see here in the first striking finding that I don't see the costophrenic angle as opposed to here, right? So the costophrenic angle is completely obliterated. And then the beautiful thing that why I say this is pleural effusion, it's the clinical examination, in addition that you can see it that it's layering. So when there is a layer in the film, it indicates that the fluid in the cavity, and remember I say fluid, and I don't know what is it, but you say fluid, it's free floating. That means that it's not a long standing involvement in the pleura. Because if it stays for a long time, and in particularly two types, whether it's related to infection or related to bleeding, that they heal with what? Fibrosis, so they can develop septa. And with the development of septa, that can cause the fusion will not be free floating. So what are you going to do to this patient? No, you will not do a trap. No.
Change position.
No. Okay. So you want to confirm your finding. If this patient has what? Right. So you want to see if this is a free-floating fluid or not. This is extremely important. Before you jump in doing any procedure to any patient, you want to see, is this a free-floating fluid or not? So basically if the affected side is in the left side, we'll ask the patient to lay on his left side. If it's in the right side, you will ask him to lay on it. So you will ask the right decubitus film if there is an abnormality on the right. And basically you want to see that if there is a fluid, it's like the cartoon illustration, you want to see it really free floating. And basically on the film, you want to see a thickness of layer of white opacity, and that should be approximately 1 centimeter of thickness. If it's 1 centimeter of thickness, then it indicates that you are okay to put a needle and aspirate the pleural cavity. But this is very old. We don't do this anymore, except you're in a remote area or other hospitals that they still don't have. Right now we have the modality which is right away on the spot, you can do it.
Ultrasound.
So we have it, you just grab the ultrasound, you put the probe, immediately you can tell that this fusion, whether free-floating or it's loculate, it doesn't matter, you can tell where is the spot of that fluid. So remember, if you don't have the ultrasound, always the priority, the first choice is ultrasound. But if you don't have the ultrasound, then the old method, which is the DQ film. Okay? Now let's suppose that you grabbed the ultrasound and you confirm this patient has a pleural effusion. What will you do next? Doesn't matter. There is a fluid in the pleural cavity. No.
Why CBC?
For platelet. Yes. So you want to know the platelet. Because you could probably cause a tragedy. A patient probably, he came to you really walking, and you could probably cripple him and send him to the ICU. Why? He could have a severe thrombocytopenia, and you just grab that needle and you just insert it, and you could cause bleeding into the pleural cavity. So very important that you want to do it before you do any kind of procedure, you always want to check the platelet. What else you want to check? Coagulation profile. So it's extremely important. Remember these two, you want to check the coagulation profile. Platelet and then the coagulation profile. These are very important. Now, you did check him and you find it's normal, fine. Then, what are you going to do? How are you going to get this? Are you thoracentesis? No. Okay, but you draw the plasma, that's fine, perfect. You draw LDH, whole protein, halalajo. But what else? طيب لو جيت انا جبت النيدل وحطيتها كذا على طول في اللعبه ايش بتسوي؟ Consent. So you have to consent your patient. You have to explain to him that I'm going to do. Doesn't mean that I'm presenting here a chest x-ray or that I'm just going to focus on chest x-ray. I'm presenting the whole life case scenario. This is what really happened. And this is the way that always you keep it in the back of your mind. Approach to a patient. not just one, just look at that x-ray and talk. So you want to consent this patient. And this is a very important. If the patient does not allow you, that's it, you stop. What if it's a life-saving? You stop, but you try to convince his family that to convince the patient, but you don't get to get consent from the family. Do you get it? So the consent is not from the family. Always the patient himself, it's not the family. Unless there is a different, you have a document that he is the guardian or something, or he is really, he cannot consent for himself, and there is a really a court order that this patient really cannot consent for himself, and this is someone who's been devoted to talk in his behalf or consent on his behalf, that's a different scenario. But if he does not agree, that's it, you stop.
If it's life-threatening.
You don't do it. You don't do it. If he says no, that's it. You stop. Absolutely. What you need to do, you document it in the family, okay? If there is no family, you document it with the nursing and other staff that someone really know that 100% that you interpret it or you explain to the patient in a proper way. Sometimes there is a miscommunication or language sometimes barrier. So you have to really make sure that this is being explained and you have witnesses. That's it. You honor his wish. Okay? You can't. I know sometimes you want to do something, but you can't. If he says no, that's it. And we've been through this, believe me. So, then you go, you put a needle and you insert it. Because you did all your homework and you're fine. Then you send it for what? Right, so we're going by the lights criteria. You want to know, is it a transudative? You want to know, is it an exudative criteria? Based on this, I'm sure you took that pleural effusion, and we're not going to talk about this in detail. Now, when you have a large effusion, meaning that occupying mid of the mid-thorax, always remember the word itch. And these are the, what are the itch? These are the causes of mid-sized pleural effusion. So it's either an infection or tumor or chylous pleural effusion or hemorrhage. Those are the four items that can cause large type of pleural effusion. So now you're an expert with this pleural effusion. You can see that amount that the pleura is involved up to mid-size of his. So this is a large pleural effusion. And it's layering very nicely, so it indicates that this is really right away a large pleural effusion, and things goes to your mind, hemorrhage, infection, chylous pleural effusion. Now, pneumothorax, again, you have a different lecture about it, and you may probably wanna, you will be probably given either through surgery. We usually divide them into spontaneous, or primary, which is the primary type, or the COPD or asthma, or secondary to other etiologies or like a blunt trauma. So the pneumothorax, what do we mean by pneumothorax? Basically an air in the pleural cavity, and it's not supposed to be there. Right now we don't want to know what causes this pneumothorax. The most important, you want to diagnose it radiologically. And how to diagnose it radiologically? If you see this line, do you see that? Mm-hmm. Right? So the lung parenchyma goes all the way up and then stops here. And then afterward, you don't see any lung parenchyma. It's just dark air. Is it clear to everybody?
Yes.
So this is what we call? Right, there is an air bronchogram, but that's because of the what happened. There is a lot of, because of the lung is being collapsed because of the large size pneumothorax. And this is why you see what it looks like or it appeared like there is a lung or air bronchogram because of the consolidation collapse occurring from the pneumothorax. Now, what would you expect the mediastinum here?
Shift.
Where? Opposite side. Okay? So if I give you a clinical scenario that trachea is shifted to the left side, right, and then absent breath sound and hyperresonant, so you know that this is most likely I'm dealing with a pneumothorax and involving in the left side. What about this, Phil? Same thing. Mm-hmm. Okay, so this is the left pneumothorax, and this is also that causing the mediastinum to be pushed toward the right. And then this is why you're... And how would you treat pneumothorax? Same protocol as the pleural effusion. Again, remember, Ishra. Okay? Remember. Same protocol. You are going to do the same thing, make sure that you're safe, and then at the end you want to aspirate this pleural cavity by putting a chest tube or a small catheter, depending on the size of this pneumothorax. No, this is in someone who has what happened in someone who previously mechanically ventilated, and when he's lying flat, that is this is what we call the deep sulcus sign. This is what we call the deep sulcus sign. So basically, when he's laying flat, he's not standing in this position. So where is the air is going? It's going to go, because it's so large, upper, and then what else? It is going also deeper. And this is what we call it, the deep sulcus sign in someone who's mechanical ventilation. In a mechanically ventilated patient, but not in this patient, you will not see this pneumothorax. You will see it in a, like a, just a deep sulcus sign, because the patient is laying flat. So this is something just extra, that's not too... So let's go with the pericardial effusion. Remember, it's always like, it's like the pleural effusion. So at the end, you want to do aspirate, right? So if it's in the heart, the pericardium, we call it pericardiocentesis. If it's in the lung, we call it, or the pleura, I mean, we call it thoracentesis. If it's in the abdomen, we call it paracentesis. So it's all synthesis. You just add the phrase before it and whatever that structure that you're going into. And they usually divide it into serous, bloody, and purulent effusion. So this is a patient who presented with shortness of breath over the past 3 weeks. And his oxygen saturation is 90% of room air, and his blood pressure is 100 over 60. So, what would you expect his physical findings? Maybe, we don't know if it's in heart failure, but we'll say that possible. So what would you expect his JVB?
High.
What also you would expect with his, when you auscultate the heart? Right, so you cannot really hear the heart sound. And then, what else? What are you going to do or document in this patient? What if you do the blood pressure? We don't know if it's cardiac tamponade or not, usually. But what if you do a blood pressure measurement? What will happen? So if it drops, by how much?
10.
By 10 millimeter of mercury. So if it drops with inspiration, so this is mostly that you're dealing with a pericardial, probably effusion, and probably an imminent cardiac tamponade. But really, the film here, sometimes it can be really very fooling. So what you need to do to document this?
Echo.
So remember, for the pleura, you will do an ultrasound. For the heart, you want to do an ultrasound, but they call it echo. So right away, you'll grab the echo, and then you can find out that he has pericardial effusion. How are you going to manage?
Same thing.
Right? Descent, and then at the end, you're going to insert a needle into the pericardium and then examine the pericardial fluid. This is a 30 years old lady who was in a good health till approximately 3 months. She noted progressive shortness of breath. She's class 3 now. She was previously taking diet pills for almost a year. And on a clinical examination, she has bilateral or lung examination reveals clear, cardiovascular examination reveals loud second heart sound with systolic murmur in the tricuspid area and also a peripheral edema. So what is the case scenario here?
Diet pills.
Systolic murmur.
High output value, high.
What's the diet pills?
Very disease.
Let's go to the here. The heart is what happened to the heart size? She has an enlargement of the heart, right? But what else here? What is this structure?
Hilum.
Okay, so this is a significantly large hilum. You will not put this as a lymph node in someone I'm presenting like this clinical scenario. So someone who's taking diet pill, what does it come to your mind?
Protein.
Doesn't matter. This is something that they use it as an anorexogenic type of pills that can cause pulmonary hypertension, severe pulmonary hypertension. But here I'm not expecting you to diagnose pulmonary hypertension, you just go through the clinical scenario. This patient has a murmur, so like you mentioned, you think about valvular disease. But the valvular disease itself is not as a cause of this heart failure because of this abnormality here, the marked engorgement of the vasculature. And the reason why I brought this and this, you can see the difference between the two. Because some people, sometimes that you get confused and you label this as a pericardial effusion, but the exam does not point out that this is a pericardial effusion. Right? Mm-hmm. Neither the exam, neither the hilum, because the hilum is here, is completely involved by this pericardial effusion. And the way that you will diagnose it, you again by echocardiography, and you can tell that this patient has a pulmonary hypertension. Mm-hmm. So you just suspect that this patient, like what you said, I want to rule out valvular disease, but also because of the significant hilar congestion, you want to think about pulmonary hypertension. So we want to do an echocardiography. Absolutely. Absolutely. You will have an enlargement predominantly where? In the right ventricle. And then you will have a tricuspid girdle because of this significant enlargement of the right ventricle, the right atrium. The systolic pulmonary artery pressure, you can measure it from the right ventricle. So all of this parameter you can determine right away and you can diagnose her on the spot. Now, another case scenario, another 40 years old gentleman presented with shortness of breath over 3 weeks and on no cough. His oxygen saturation is 88% of room air, blood pressure 120 over 80. Clinical exam revealed decreased asymmetrical chest expansion and resonant to percussion and absent breath sound with area bronchial breath sound. So what does this film indicate? So is this a pleural effusion?
No.
Why you say no, this is not a pleural effusion? Clinical examination does not support this is a pleural effusion, right? Right? I didn't say stolid illness. So I said resonant. So this is very unusual for a pleural effusion. And the pleural effusion, what do you expect with the pleural effusion?
Pushing.
Not pulling. So what's happening here? Look at the mediastinum. So the whole mediastinum is being pulled toward the affected side. So this is most likely what your colleague says, it's a collapse. Now, what is really a collapse? Well, let's go over here the anatomy. Look at the trachea. Going through the, here the air, and then the bifurcation going into the right, and then all the way to the left, and then stops. So when we see that sign, we immediately tell this is really an abrupt cutoff sign. There is an abnormality in the endobronchial. And in addition, this is the white opacity. Why it's a white opacity? No air. So there is no air. That's why it's a white opacity. So you have an abnormality here, whether it's in the inside the lumen, or it's in the wall, or something is pushing outside and causing this luminal narrowing. So remember, this is the way that you always keep it in the back of your mind or interpret. If you're dealing with a gallbladder, the same thing, or a common bile duct, you will say it is either inside the wall, a lumen, within the wall, or outside. Esophagus, the same thing. The trachea, the bronchi, the same thing. So this is the way that you interpret. But B, having really the abrupt cutoff sign, this indicates that there is something inside the lumen. So if you presented this picture in as 8 or 6 years old, what does it come to your mind?
Foreign
body, right away. But in a, someone who's middle aged, then you think probably of slow growing tumor. Foreign body still kept in the back of your mind, but slow growing tumor is also a possibility. So what would you do to this patient?
ABC.
ABC. Remember, don't lose this. Don't lose this mark, yeah, Shabab? Stick by, just say it. I want to make sure. This. What else? So
ABG.
Breathing, circulation, your mental everything. What else?
ABG.
Okay.
That's CT.
Why CT? How is the CT is going to help you? Nothing. The head X-ray here is telling you everything. So why CT? You want to do CT for this patient? How the CT will tell you? Just going to tell you that the whole lung is collapsed, but it's not going to tell you anything inside the lung. And that will somewhat within a second. It will, you just expose your patient for radiation and nothing.
Examination.
No, where do you want to go?
Examination.
Right. Like your friend, but are you going to do it or are you going to go consent?
Consent.
And then you will go for the bronchoscopy. Why you want to go for the bronchoscopy?
Diagnostic and therapeutic.
Right. So this is the same patient.
What is this?
So this is the same patient that we went through a bronchoscopy, and he has a carcinoid tumor, and it was removed, and it immediately the whole lung expanded. So the bronchoscopy, always keep it in the back of your mind. Either it's diagnostic or therapeutic. So either you want to diagnose or you want to remove therapeutic, either remove a foreign body, remove a tumor, whatever is this causing this obstruction.
Doctor, where was the carcinoid tumor?
Inside the lumen.
Trachea or bronchia?
Bronchia, left main stem bronchus. So you can probably appreciate that this is why I was going back and forth, between a case of pericardial effusion and a case of pulmonary hypertension. Don't be fooled. Listen and be careful when you read the case history. You will not expect a patient with a pulmonary hypertension with a muffled heart sound, right? And with pulsus paradoxus. So be careful, read the case very carefully. Which one is pleural effusion and which one is the collapse? So this is effusion?
Collapse.
Because of? Right. And here? The effusion. So be careful when someone telling you the trachea is shifted toward and all of these. It's not haphazardly mentioned. So just keep it in the back of your mind. All right, thank you.
Thank you, Dr.